Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. We have on the show with us today Dr. Cornelius Hunter. He is a graduate of the University of Illinois, where he earned a PhD in biophysics and computational biology. He is also adjunct professor at Biola University and author of the award-winning Darwin's God, Evolution and the Problem of Evil. Hunter's other books are well known to folks who follow the intelligent design movement. They include Darwin's Proof, and his newest book is Science's Blind Spot. It came out by Baker Brazos Press about 2 years ago. And his interest in this issue involves many different angles, including the historical, theological, as well as scientific aspects of the theory. Dr. Hunter's new blog, which we're actually going to talk about today, is darwinsgod.blogspot.com. That's darwins-god.blogspot.com. And his new website is also darwinspredictions.com. So, Dr. Hunter, thank you very much for coming on the ID the Future podcast with us today.
Oh, Casey, thank you so much for having me on again. I look forward to it.
Well, you're always doing interesting new projects. If it's not a book, it looks like these days it is a lot of internet work. And your new blog, darwins-god.blogspot.com, and your new website, darwinspredictions.com, are what I'd like to talk to you about today. So let's start off with your blog, darwins-god.blogspot.com. You started this blog May of 2009, but you've still covered a lot of topics ranging from junk DNA to cosmic fine-tuning to protein evolution, atheism and evolution, and of course, the recent hype over this Ida fossil or Darwinist Malassezay. So here's my question for you. There are a million evolution blogs out there. Why did you create darwins-god.blogspot.com?
Good question, Casey. Yeah, there are a lot of evolution blogs out there. Both pro and con. But, you know, most people miss the religion in evolution that is so crucial. And, of course, I have written books on this, as you mentioned, and they're the religious foundation of evolution. Until you understand that, you don't really understand what's going on in this debate. It underlies everything. And the blog gives readers a chance to see the religion as it plays out in the evolution genre on a day-to-day basis. Every day, there are more and more articles that come out that have this religion either implicit or explicit. It could be in a journal article. It could be in a newspaper article written by a journalist who is pro-evolution or a magazine article, etc. There's just so much of it out there as it plays out in the debate today that I thought that a blog was really needed to show people this and why it makes sense. So my theme is, religion drives science, and it matters.
Well, I'll definitely give your blog my plug. I think people should visit it because it covers a lot of topics with grace and style, and also because, as I've said before, you're one of the few people, Dr. Hunter, where I can say that I usually agree with just about everything you write. So don't get me into any trouble here, but I definitely endorse your blog. As a matter of fact, your 37th post, which I hadn't actually looked at yet, is great. You actually stole my idea, something that I have actually written a blog post draft for Evolution News about the idea of junk proteins. It hasn't quite gotten published yet. Maybe I can link to yours and share the credit with you, or maybe give you the credit, because you beat me to the punch talking about how evolutionists are so wedded to the idea of junk. First they had junk DNA, then they had junk RNA, and I was going to predict that they're going to come out with the idea of junk proteins soon. So actually, you know what? I've talked about it once before on the ID the Future podcast, so I can say that I beat you to it, but this is a great little post you have here, how they're just so in love and enamored with the idea of junk that, you know, we'll make it all the way to proteins, and it'll still be junk, right? Right?
Well, they really are, but, you know, it predates the whole genomic era and proteomics. It didn't begin with DNA. The idea that biology is full of non-designs, of kludges, it's one big fluke. And so it's natural for the evolutionists, their first take on anything in biology is going to be that it's happenstance. It's a claptrap. And if it works at all, we're lucky. And so that's the basic take of the evolutionist. And it's always turning out to be wrong.
I would certainly very much agree with what you're saying, Dr. Hunter. As a matter of fact, this idea of junk proteins, I'll give a sneak preview of what I'm going to be blogging about on Evolution News in the not-too-distant future, hopefully. Basically, you know, I was wondering, has anybody else actually thought of this idea before I kind of came up with this idea that, oh, I bet there are evolutionists out there that are claiming there are junk proteins. So I actually searched for junk proteins on Google and found a scientific paper that was claiming, and this was actually from a few years back, this is not from this recent story, that was claiming that a lot of proteins, actual DNA gets transcribed and then translated, and the information it gets converted into protein, and it's still junk. And so this idea is, I guess none of us can take credit for it. Some evolutionists had actually already thought of it.
That is an excellent nugget. I'm glad you came up with that. It's like a prediction come true for you. And the thing I like about it is it confirms what I'm talking about here, is that the religion drives the science. And that's why one reason why the religion is so important. Not only does the religion make evolution a fact, and you hear this claim over and over from evolutionists that it is a fact every bit as much as gravity is a fact, that claim right there should tip you off that there's something funny, something fishy going on in evolution. But what the religion is not just a harmless aside here. It drives the science into places where it shouldn't go, and we're getting bad science over and over again. And this whole junk DNA, junk protein claim is just one example of many. So really, at the end of the day, we're dealing with a problem with science.
Well, you mentioned a prediction coming true. This leads into what actually I also want to talk to you about today, your new website, darwinspredictions.com. Again, there are a million evolution websites out there. So what motivated you to create darwinspredictions.com?
Right. Well, you know, I've done a lot of debating with evolutionists, and you cover a wide range of evidences. And the evolutionists will usually say, well, you know, yeah, you're pointing out a problem with the theory, but we can explain that. We've got this new sub-theory coming along. We've modified the theory, and we can now explain that. So, you know, that's not a problem anymore. So it occurred to me that, you know, what good is a compass when it's always wrong? They're always having to adjust their compass. A better way to understand evolution is to look at the history of the predictions that it has made and see how those have fared. So if you're always having to adjust and correct and make new adjustments to the theory, the suggestion here is that the theory itself isn't very good. It's not helping science very much. So let's look at the history of predictions. Now, of course, theories often have true predictions and false predictions, and it's the false predictions that are interesting. They tend to tell you more about the theory, although both are important. So what's particularly interesting about evolution is that it has bred dozens of what you would think of as fundamental predictions gone wrong. These are not tangential predictions that are out there on the edge that don't really matter. These are fundamental predictions. Of course, there's many tangential predictions that have gone wrong as well. But it's interesting in evolution that the majority, if not all, of its fundamental predictions have gone wrong in interesting ways. So that's what the website really gets at, is understanding and teaching people to evaluate the theory of evolution in a proper way to understand that it really doesn't lead to good science typically.
Well, I just can't recommend your new website, darwinspredictions.com, enough, Dr. Hunter. It's really a one-stop shop for a history of failed predictions of evolution, and it's very, very rich and heavy-laden with science and technical citations, but yet you have a lot of quotes that are very accessible, I would say, to any readers. So if you are a student or an educator interested in sort of a one-stop shop with a very unique experience of learning about some of the failed predictions of evolution, and I know, Dr. Hunter, you could probably put many more up there, but the ones you've got are excellent, go to darwinspredictions.com. One of my favorite sections of darwinspredictions.com is the section on the objections of evolutionists, basically objections that evolutionists will raise to your claim that evolution is sort of a history of failed predictions. I'd like to go through some of those objections real quick, but first I'd like to know, how did you pick out those particular objections that you list on darwinspredictions.com?
Right. Well, these objections come right from the evolutionists themselves. As I said, I've debated evolutionists extensively. I've heard these over and over again. So these come from the literature. These come from debates, from the Internet. Anyone who debates evolutionists can expect to see several of these objections come up in the debate. So they are important to understand for readers.
Well, your first objection is ad hominem attacks. I can definitely vouch, as you said, that that is one that anybody who debates evolutionists will probably experience quite a bit. How common are these ad hominem attacks, and have you been the recipient of these? And of course, could you also explain to us what is an ad hominem attack?
Right. So, of course, ad hominem is Latin for to the person. So you raise an objection to evolution, and they will say something bad about you. You're not smart. You're a fool. You don't know what you're talking about. You haven't had the proper training and so forth. So they'll ignore the argument and go to the person. They are common. As you said, you've been the recipient of it. Anyone in this debate, anyone who questions evolution undoubtedly will run into ad hominem attacks one way or another. They're kind of the first step for evolutionists. That's the first go-to is try to dismiss the attack to begin with by dismissing the person. Dismissal is a real important part. Demonization and dismissal are important parts of the evolutionary response. It's very common, and it really shows how deep this debate goes. This is not merely about evaluating some scientific evidence. We're dealing with some deeply held religious beliefs, and the debate quickly becomes personal. Evolutionists really are often not able to process criticism intellectually and engage in the evidence. It typically doesn't get to that point. Another aspect of this ad hominem attack is uncharitable reading of your work. You'll take whatever you write and twist it in some way that was unintended, or find a mistake that you made that really is not germane to your argument, and ignore the argument itself, which is problematic for them, and instead focus on, you know, whatever mistakes you made in presenting it. So that's a real tip-off that there's a problem with the theory. They're making up straw man arguments versus what you actually are, the criticism actually says.
This is, of course, what Michael Behe called in his response to Ken Miller back in January, the principle of least charitable reading, which often goes on, unfortunately. And I think you're right. You can often tell the strength of a person's position, not necessarily by the specific arguments they make, but by the type of arguments they make. And when they resort to all this kind of, as you said, demonization and accusations and personal attacks, I mean, that says something.
It really does, Casey, and you know, it makes me reflect on my own experience when I was evaluating evolution for myself, and I really had no reason to believe it wasn't true. I really just wanted to understand the claim, evolution as a fact. What does that mean, and how do I know that it's a fact? And I just set about reading through the evolution literature, finding my goal was to build the very best case evolution that I could. I wanted to get the strongest arguments. You can find plenty of weak arguments, and you can find plenty of mistakes. Evolutionists, like anybody else, make mistakes. That's very common in the evolution literature. I ignore those. I don't dwell on those. I don't bring those out in my critique. That's not going to get me anywhere. I'm not interested in a critique of evolution that is based on the weak points. I want to build the strongest case for evolution. I'd love to be an evolutionist. I'd go there immediately if that was supported by the evidence. But it's not. And so, you know, I think of my own experience of building the strongest case that I can for evolution and really understanding what evolutionists are saying and trying to be sympathetic to their point. And I do acknowledge the strengths of their arguments. They have very strong arguments. But then to see what they do in response, yeah, very much is telling, as you say.
Well, let's keep moving on to some other objections. You also mentioned the brush-off response. What does that mean?
Right. It's just with a wave of the hand. I was in one debate, and I went through about a dozen falsified predictions of evolution. And the evolutionist sat there listening and got to the end, and his response was, those are all fallacies. and the audience quickly agreed with him, and we went on to other topics. It was the brush-off, just not even addressing the issues at hand. And it really is remarkable to find out, when you engage with evolutionists, just how little they know about the actual evidential problems with the theory of evolution and the evidence bearing on the questions. And that's a little disturbing, too. I spoke with one evolutionist who claimed, "Oh no, you know, I'm really on top of it. I've read the literature opposing evolution. I've got my own personal library of books that are skeptical of evolution and so forth." So I asked him a few questions about the details. Well, he'd tell me some titles and so forth, and it really wasn't there. He hadn't read any of the real quality works that were questioning Darwin's theory.
Your third objection is probably a bit of a sophisticated one, but I also think it's one of the most important ones. You call this the falsificationism is flawed objection, namely stating that it's naive to think that one bad prediction somehow falsifies a theory. And of course, this enters the realm of demarcation criteria, where the classic criticism of falsification is that many scientists do not actually behave as if the core claims of their theories are falsifiable, since it's always easy to invent some ad hoc theory to account for the failed prediction. But you're not making a case against evolution based upon naive falsificationism. In fact, what you're doing is something much more wholesale and generalized, and trying to take, as you said, the strongest case for evolution and assessing the health of the theory in general by asking what bad predictions has Darwinism made over history and how have evolutionists reacted to those bad predictions. Could you comment on the falsificationist flawed objection?
This really is another sign of a problem. Philosophers of science have figured out that, yeah, you can't falsify a theory with a single false prediction. There's classic examples in the history of science of what we think of as very good theories that generated a bad prediction. The bad prediction was later discovered to be explainable. We just didn't know enough. So you want to be careful about picking up a bad prediction and crying, aha, this theory must be wrong. What's interesting about that is evolutionists will turn that into a defense. So you can list off, as I said, a dozen bad predictions of evolution, really making a case that this is more than just a one-time problem, but we really have a symptomatic problem, a structural problem with the theory. And they'll wave this flag of, oh, well, falsification doesn't matter. So they've got the ultimate protection for their theory. False predictions don't matter anymore. You can list off dozens and dozens, and they're unfazed. So I list this as an objection to be aware of, but in fact, as you say, my website has right now 13, I'll be adding more, false predictions that are really fundamental to the theory. So nonetheless, I've had people respond to this website with exactly this claim, oh, well, you're just engaging in falsificationism. No, it's not. It's really looking at the, as you say, the wholesale, generalized assessment of the theory.
You also address the quote mining charge, namely that some authorities that you quote believe in evolution, and therefore somehow that makes it inappropriate or worse for you to quote those authorities when they discuss weaknesses in some of evolution's core claims. So why is this a fallacious objection to your website?
Right. So, I mean, you have to give some evidences in any argument. You have to cite authorities and cite papers and scientific findings. What if you were to cite opponents of evolution? Of course, the evolutionists would be all over that. They'd say, well, this is biased, this is bad science, this is biased opinions, you're citing opponents of evolution to begin with. So, why do I make the habit of citing evolutionists? In court of law, the most powerful witness is the sympathetic witness. You want to use the words of evolutionists because they are more powerful. If an evolutionist admits that a prediction is false, then there's little debate that prediction is false. The evolutionist then comes back at you with the rebuttal that, well, but that person believes in evolution. Well, that's exactly the point. I'm using a sympathetic witness. So their words carry more. They're admitting that there's a false prediction. Well, it's been well known for a century or more that people don't change their minds easily. So the fact that someone is an evolutionist means very little. What we need to do is look at the evidence, not look what the positions that people hold.
That's very true. At the end of the day, the evidence is what matters more than anything. But you raised a very good point that when a person has a particular viewpoint and they make a statement that counters their own position, that is considered to be very strong evidence. And, you know, you mentioned in a court of law, that's exactly right. In the rules of evidence, hearsay is usually not admissible, i.e., if I say that, oh, John told me that Susie stole a candy bar from the store, well, that's not evidence in a court of law. You can't just go off of what somebody else said as proof. However, let's say that Susie told that she stole the candy bar. Well, that actually could be admitted into evidence in a court of law because it's called an admission by a party opponent. The idea is exactly as you said, that someone usually does not admit a fact against their own position unless it is true. Susie would not usually lie about, you know, the fact that she stole a candy bar. If she's saying that, she's not making it up. It probably actually is true. It's something we would usually consider to be a true statement, and it tends to be more reliable. So admissions by an evolutionist, rather than being a weak quote, actually should be considered a very strong quote according to the way that at least our legal system treats different lines of evidence. I want to address two more objections here, and I think that, Dr. Hunter, we're going to have to save a lot of the failed predictions of Darwinism for a second podcast. So let's go over two more quick objections here. One is what you call the, quote, God would never have created this world objection, which obviously fits closely with the topic of your first book, Darwin's God, Evolution, and the Problem of Evil, which is a great read, by the way. So can you explain this objection to us?
Well, this gets right to the heart of the religion that underlies and is the foundation of evolution. It is built on religious claims made by Christians and other theists and picked up by non-theists before Darwin, during Darwin's day, and up to today. So it's pervasive. It's been around for centuries. And it's a religious view about how God would interact with the world. It's fairly sophisticated theological concepts, but they have to do with God not creating evil, God not mixing it up with worms and minutiae that are beneath God. God would never dwell on the details. God would not be capricious. God would not create designs that are just one of many. He would not do one thing that isn't necessarily better than another. So that's an interesting one. So there's actually about a dozen or more of these theological traditions going on centuries leading up to Darwin trying to explain natural history. Problem of evil is, you know, the most prominent, the most interesting probably of them all. God would not create evil, great classic problem. Kant, Leibniz, Hume, these are leading, most influential philosophers and theologians and scientists in the Enlightenment years making these religious claims. You know, we often hear that the Enlightenment was the rejection of religion and religious influence. It was exactly the opposite. The Enlightenment was the codification of religious influence. And very much religious arguments and religious influences became stronger and stronger and embedded in science. And so to this day, it really is probably the most powerful argument for evolution is the problem of evil. So this is one that you'll hear as well. Yes, I understand that there are scientific problems, but look, God wouldn't do this. God wouldn't have created this. And it's, of course, it's a non-scientific argument. Regardless of whether it's true or not, it's not something that the scientific evidence can address. And that really was what underlies the theory of evolution. This is why it's really a religious theory. It's not a scientific theory. The science is the window dressing, but the core elements of evolution are not natural selection, that they can forfeit natural selection. It's not a gradual change. They can forfeit gradual change. It's not punctuated equilibrium. They can forfeit that. It's not mutations, et cetera, et cetera. The core element of evolution is naturalism. Everything has to happen naturally through natural processes because that absolves God, that distances God from the world and from creation. And that solves this list of theological issues that was ongoing before and up to Darwin's day and continuing to today. So that's an objection that you're going to run into today, but it is the classic objection and motivation for evolution.
Okay, let's talk about one last objection that evolutionists make. When they are confronted with their failed predictions, they will sometimes ask, well, what about all the successful predictions? How does this objection play out?
Right. Well, okay, I discussed this in the website and how do we properly evaluate scientific theories. Successful predictions are easy to come by. And a geocentrism is a good example. The theory that the Earth is at the center of the universe, the stars, the planets, the sun, the moon, they rotate about the Earth. Very successful theory, very accurate theory. You can predict eclipses and arise times and setting times of celestial objects very accurately. It's full of successful predictions. The flat Earth theory that's used commonly by engineers and physicists today, even today, for all kinds of problems that they work on. Very successful theory and false. Here we have a couple of examples that are outright false, but yet generate successful predictions on an ongoing basis. What's more interesting is the false predictions that they make and how to account for those. So does evolution make successful predictions? Sure, there's some successful predictions in evolution, but what's fascinating is the degree and extent of the false predictions. There really is no comparison. I mean, the successful predictions pale in comparison to the scope and magnitude of the false predictions. They dwarf the successful predictions.
Yes, I don't think that flat Earth theory will help you very much if you're flying across the country and when you land, you suddenly realize that the time zone has changed. You won't get a very good explanation for that out of flat Earth theory. So, definitely it's the failed predictions that matter, and that's what drives science to make new discoveries. Dr. Hunter, your website is darwinspredictions.com. Your blog is darwins-god.blogspot.com. We're going to have to take a second podcast to actually talk about the failed predictions of evolution that you talk about on your website. So can you stay with us?
Yes, I can, Casey. I look forward to it.
Okay, excellent. Well, I'm Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast. Stay with us for more with Dr. Cornelius Hunter, author of Darwin's God, Evolution, and the Problem of Evil, and recent creator of the blog darwins-god.blogspot.com and the website darwinspredictions.com. I'm Casey Luskin. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.